Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Back to another episode. This week we're going to be taking a look at 2002 fantasy adventure movie Reign of Fire. It was directed by a guy named Rob Bowman, and Rob Bowman kind of made his bones on the X-Files TV show that he directed many episodes for, and then went on to direct the X-Files movie. Basically, the X-Files movie was 1998, and Reign of Fire was his next feature in 2002. There's very little background information about Reign of Fire. There's nothing on Wikipedia. IMDb is sketchy. I own the DVD version of it. There's like making of the dragon effects on it. So I really don't have any background. The writers who co-wrote it, I think these two guys, didn't do much more. The writers were Greg Chabot and Kevin Paterka. And then this guy, Matt Greenberg, who I think it sounded like the former two guys kind of came up with the concept, and maybe Greenberg was brought on for a polish because he's done a bunch of stuff. Yeah, that's kind of it. I mean, I can talk about the cast a little bit. It's a hell of a cast, actually. Christian Bale and Matthew McConaughey are the two big leads. Isabella Scorupco, who was a Bond girl, I think her most famous thing that she did. And Gerard Butler is in it as well. In a lesser role, Deep Space Nine's Dr. Bashir, Alexander Siddig, I think he's a radio operator in this film. And Alice Krieg is in it briefly as our hero's mother in the sort of the prelude. And Alice Krieg was the Borg Queen. So there's a little bit of a Star Trek kind of crossover here. And I believe that's not unintentional, as Bowman also directed multiple episodes of Star Trek Next Gen. So without further to-do, let's jump into Reign of Fire. We open in sort of modern-day London of 2002. We open on a young boy, and it's the childhood version of Quinn Abercrombie, who's later going to be the main protagonist of the film, played by Christian Bale. So we're kind of following him to this building site where he enters to visit, we're not sure whom, but as he enters, all the people who are there kind of know him, and we gather that he's come there very often. And he goes down this long elevator, down this very deep shaft that's being dug, and that elevator and that shaft will come into play much later in the film. And his mother is down there, played by Alice Krieg, the Borg Queen from Next Gen. And she is a mining engineer of some kind, and he, I guess, has gotten out of school, and, you know, he goes to see her and kind of hangs out at the job site after school. And some brief information, he's gotten a scholarship rejection letter, and we hear that his mother can't afford schooling on her own. The father has vanished with no not where. Now the story starts in earnest. The drill that has been boring the tunnel that they're making has hit what they call a void. So they pull it out, and there's a vast cavern and chamber behind it. And one of the workers is kind of a dick. Quinn kind of wanders down, and he's talking to the guy. And the guy's like, why don't you climb in there and take a look? Like, they're going to let some little kid, you know, climb into a construction site cave on his own. But it's important for the story. So, you know, there you go. We see this massive cave structure from the beams of the flashlight. A lot of lighting stuff with Rob Bowman because, you know, X-Files, right? He's very good at having a very darkened scene or a landscape, and you know the glare of the flashlights, right, for Mulder and Scully whenever they're doing their things. He really likes that contrast, and we see a little bit of that here. Quinn walks in, and he sees these strange shapes that look kind of like stone carvings of some kind. He gets up very close to one. It's a little ribbed, as if it was sort of scales, which, you know, we kind of get it right from the beginning. Then looking up, he sees a live dragon, and briefly in the screen we kind of get a sense of the dragon, and he runs and bails out of the cave, and his mother grabs him, and something is happening inside the cave, and so his mother and he get to the elevator cage and start going up, just as these two workmen are engulfed by this incredible outpouring of flame. Then we get kind of a wide shot, and as they're traveling up the elevator, this monstrous dragon comes up, briefly claws onto the elevator cage. The head is kind of level with where Quinn is standing, and they make eye contact. Quinn looks at the beast looks at Quinn, and then it's off. And that will be a point that we'll come back to much later in the film. But as it leaves, what has happened is when the dragon impacted the elevator shaft, it did something to the car, and his mother is dead. And we see that it kind of deformed the cage in such a way that his mother got caught in it, and his mother is dead. So now we get into a montage from Christian Bale as the adult version of Quinn, and we're shown this montage of newspaper clippings, these monstrous winged shapes moving in the background, and we hear the dragons, now they're named, that hole and that escape from that the dragons multiplied unbelievably quickly and engulfed the entire planet, burning everything they could. And then we hear kind of an alternate history. These dragons are cyclical, kind of reminded me of like what they're doing with the new Godzilla. These cyclical giant monsters continue to return to existence, you know, when they're needed or when there's, you know, necessary in these long eon-like cycles. What they're positing here is that the dinosaurs weren't destroyed by climate change or possibly triggered by that massive asteroid hit or meteor hit, but that these monstrous dragons came out of hibernation even back in the millions of years ago and burned the dinosaurs to dust. And sort of, you know, they come out cyclically and they basically burn the entire planet to ash, and they feed on ash, which is a very clever thing, because if you think about it, dragons burning things is not so great. If they actually feed on meat, and they wind up torching and incinerating most things that they go after, you know, not much to chow on. So I like the little shift here in that the dragons actually feed on ash. So what they want to do when they escape is burn everything they possibly can, burn as much organic life as possible, and they feed on that organic ash. Wow, which you don't find out about that until a little bit later, but I just wanted to throw it in here because I think it's a really cool little idea. We also see that at some point the human race was kind of going down and they tried nukes. So besides the fiery burning and desolation of the dragons, there's nuclear fallout and nuclear destruction as well. And they tried to kill, great numbers of these species by using nukes, and which obviously failed. You know, so then we're left with that setup, and it's like a B-adventure movie that's taken, so far, seems to be taken pretty seriously. Why not? You know, I think it's kind of cool, the myth of dragons, right? Dragons are all over all mythology in all different countries, like, you know, Japanese has their version of a dragon, England has them. You know, wherever you go, there are these mythological, you know, old beasts, possibly sprouting fire, possibly flying, and to use that in this very practical B-movie way, I thought, you know, I remember the first time I saw it, I was like, oh man, this is right in my wheelhouse, you know, I'm totally on board. So then we finally start the story proper, and we see a bear torso Christian Bale ripped to the gills, as him and both McConaughey are. He's leading survivors underground and digging tunnels. We're getting the sense that there's just recently been a sprinkler system put in down there, so there's a little very practical touch of, like, you know, having a sprinkler system in underground tunnels that you would hide in from dragon fire, which can be cooled by just gravity tanks. I thought that was kind of neat. And we get a title card that we are in Northumberland, England, and the year is 2020. Quinn gets word that someone tells him, like, Eddie's gone crazy, you know, you better get up here. So now the camera follows Quinn as he runs up the tunnels and runs up. And we see the exteriors of this beautiful old castle, which I think they filmed probably in Scotland. But it's also adorned, it's kind of adorned also with radio towers and scaffolds and these wind turbines. So it's this kind of post-apocalyptic castle setup, you know. And we are in kind of medieval times in a sense because of the desolation, but there's also kind of the post-apocalypse where there's some tech as well. So I thought it was kind of a nice mix, a nice touch. So we're immediately presented with a real-life problem that, you know, this is, I just want to say up front, I think this is a really crackerjack story. What I love about B-movies, really good B-movies, is what they really are is concept and story. Maybe not the best dialogue, maybe not the best action, maybe some things kind of don't work. But for me, a really good B-movie is a marriage of a really cool concept and then a story that's put together in a really, really great way. That's just, everything matters. It moves along. You know, there's not a lot of hooey. We just kind of go, we kind of plow through the story. We rely on the concept and the way it's done to bring us through. You know, there's not a lot of other things that have to happen. and they don't focus on things that an A movie might be, where, you know, you're going to have more in-depth character studies, you're going to have a size where you're going to build character, set pieces might be a little bigger, there may be a little more extraneous stuff because you want to see big money up on the screen, but in a B movie, you kind of have to get to it, and you're really relying on the story and the concept to bring you through, and I think Reign of Fire is a great example of this, even from the beginning. So as he's racing out, one of the survivors who lives in the castle, his name is Eddie, wants to head out to the fields a few miles away from the castle and harvest these crops that they've been growing. And the argument that Quinn gives him is they need to wait until they're much more ripe and they germinate and produce seeds so they can harvest the seeds so they can start to not just produce food for the moment, but to, you know, start to stockpile and begin to be able to do seasonal growing and planting. But we see this guy, Eddie, is frightened. There's really a lot of children in the castle. So he's like, we're starving, we need food. And we're hearing the sense that there are other settlements that they've had been in contact with, and they're slowly going dark. So people are kind of, things are kind of dropping out of sight. They're probably one of the last. And we hear that it's been 8 years since that settlement has formed, and probably since the dragon emergence. And Bale is great here. I mean, the acting is really first rate in the whole film. I mean, I immediately buy into the story because of the conviction of Bale. And even Gerard Butler, who I think later on has kind of become just kind of like a, I don't know, he headlines movies once in a while, but I never kind of buy into Gerard Butler movies very much because he never really seems like he's doing too much work. He kind of walks around the movie in kind of a quasi-smug way, and I never really buy into anything he's doing. But even he's good here, and of course, you know, McConaughey is fantastic when he gets here. But it adds to the grit of this B-movie where you got this great crackerjack story and actors who are really committed together really makes for a terrific start. So Quinn stops him from going, takes the keys to the Jeep, and then we cut to one of my favorite parts of the movie, which has nothing to do with dragons and fighting an adventure. But what's happening is, so because there's so many children, they have to do a lot of things to kind of educate the children and teach them things and, you know, so they grow up and are able to survive in this new world. And part of what they do at night, the Gerard Butler character, his name is Creedy, and Quinn do live stage adaptations of Star Wars. So we cut to sort of a children's theater. Quinn is playing Darth Vader and Creedy is playing Luke. And it's the whole scene from The Empire Strikes Back when Luke and Vader have their final saber battle and Luke gets his hand cut off and it ends with, I am your father. And the kids are like, oh my God. And you know when we do the lines from the movie, the camera pans out and shows the reaction of the kids. And I just thought it was the funniest thing and just so brilliant that Star Wars and the power of myth and the mythology and the mythic structure and all that stuff, which Star Wars is kind of our, like comic books, right? They're like our modern mythology in a certain way. And that were a cataclysm to happen or something like this to happen, that Star Wars itself would become part of the new mythology of the generations to come, such to the point where they wouldn't even know that it came from a movie. It would just be this mythological story. And I was like, that's so genius, you know, just really tickled me. I loved it. When the play's over, then they have this long prayer with the kids. And the prayer is all about teaching the kids vigilance about the dragon. It's sort of, what do we do when we sleep? We keep one eye looking at the sky. What do we do when we do this? We keep one nose to the ground. You know, they're also trying to train these kids where it becomes rote in their DNA when they grow up of, you know, being aware that dragons are up and around and out and that, you know, in a sense, their instinct, part of what they're going to build into their instinct as adults is instinctive ways to live and survive from these creatures. We cut right to another event. Eddie, who was stopped from leaving, now steals the keys when everyone's sleeping and he takes off with like four or five other people and heads to the fields where the food is growing. So we see them arrive at this kind of this field, and there's all kinds of different stuff growing, and they start to just grab food off the vine and eat it. And then back at the castle, an alarm is sounded, and the populace motivates. I think they use like hawks to kind of sound the alarm. Like when dragons are in the sky, the hawks kind of retreat out of the sky and into the castle. And when that happens, they sound the alarm, and the entire populace now motivates. And it's a great interior castle set. It feels very authentic, you know, like there's all this stone around, but there's all kinds of bric-a-brac, you know, of it being kind of a modern place where people live and, you know, kitchen equipment and just stuff laying around. Like it looks really authentic. And then they all go underground to those tunnels that we saw in the beginning. And at that moment, Quinn realizes that there's four people missing and it's Eddie and the other three who took the truck to go to the fields. So we cut back to the fields, and a dragon is now in the air and begins to strafe and torch the fields. Again, we're not given full shots of the dragon. It's very artful how they do the dragon photography here. I really like it. It's not, you know, home run stuff. It's not Godzilla 2014, right? But they do amazing work with things from the distance. The dragons always kind of feel very naturalistic. I never, from when these distance and kind of silhouette shots, I never really feel like they're fake. They kind of feel real to me. And I think Bowman was very artful in giving, you know, probably a B-movie's funds in a way to, you know, he didn't have tons to spend on this. And he did a very artful job, I thought, of making me really feel like these dragons were real creatures and not necessarily seeing them very intensely close up. So the dragon torches the truck that's there, blowing it up, so they're kind of screwed. And there's a moment when the four of them are trapped, there's fire on all sides, and we think they're going to die. And then Quinn comes striding through the burning crops in a fireman's, you know, fireproof suit. And there's a truck behind him spraying water to allow him to walk through it. So they sort of, he forms this lane and gets them out, and now there's sort of this tension rescue as they all hop in the truck and head back towards the castle. And the dragon now lands right in front of the truck, and it looks great here. There's a little bit of a sheen of CGI on it, but still really, really cool looking, and I really buy it. So there's this, you know, this kind of cat and mouse chase where it's breathing fire. They have this water. They're keeping themselves wet and cooler. You know, they finally get back and escape in the fire truck, and the dragon moves off. And at one point, the dragon actually stops attacking them, and we now is when we hear, why is it distracted? Well, the fields are burning now, because so there's ash being created, and that's what the dragon feeds on. So it's now distracted, and it heads for the fields, and as they're burning down, it now will begin to eat the ash and sustain itself. So we get this conversation between Quinn and Creedy about how they are they getting less food from the crops each year, and it's becoming harder to grow. The world is almost depopulated as well, and the dragons are much hungrier because they've pretty much burnt everything they can, and they've, you know, eaten most of the organic ashes they can. And so their numbers are still high, but there's less and less things to eat, so their behavior is a little more intense, and they're much hungrier. And so now we get a little bit more of a montage as Quinn kind of sits back and thinks. We see kind of the camera leafs through a stack of old news magazines, and we're getting a sense of how the world actually crumbled under the onslaught. Magazine titles such as Is This the End? And so on and so forth. So we get a little bit of, you know, finishing up of that arc of from the beginning of the film to where they are now. We do get the information, and even Quinn admits that those crops were kind of their last hope, and they are now facing starvation. So there's a real problem on their hands right now. But immediately, the story kicks in to deal with it. Alexander Siddig is the radio operator from DS9, and he gets a signal. He hears chatter on the channel. One of the spotters in the castle sees a convoy of tanks and armored vehicles moving towards the castle. And the alarm sounds, and they take up arms. And I just love that. It's very Nolan, actually, where, you know, you got this story. It's dealing with the crops. You're talking about starvation. What are we going to do next? And then next happens. There's not a lot of other shots. They don't have to reinforce this. There's not another dragon attack. There's not other side stories. I mean, you know, if they're interesting, fine, but it's just, it's a story engine. So here you have the problem, and now in come is a possible solution to it in the form of, you know, the Americans and this armored division or this armored group that's come. Now we enter Matthew McConaughey and his U.S. crew, and he looks amazing. He's bald, bearded, and really ripped. And he's got these crazy spike tattoos all over him. Looks fantastic. And one of the castle dwellers says, only one thing worse than a dragon, Americans. So a little nod in the ribs to our British friends. And it's interesting to see, not many actors can share the stage with Christian Bale. He's a pretty intense actor. McConaughey is certainly one of them, and they are very much equal in intensity. It's great to see them on screen together. So McConaughey's character is named Van Zant, and he calls his men the Kentucky Irregulars. The story here is that he's flown in from the U.S. and their cargo plane crashed not far off. And we get some information that then Quinn, of course, immediately, you know, obviously in these kind of post-apocalyptic scenarios, right, any outsiders are just going to try to come and steal and kill for what they can get. And of course, Quinn is very paranoid. And he kind of spits back, there hasn't been any, and no one's been able to be in the air for 20 years. And then we hear McConaughey's little spiel about, there's this monologue about killing a dragon. He shows Quinn a tooth around his neck. And he's like, I killed the first dragon in Kansas City. And he's got this wonderful long monologue that Bowman gives him, which is awesome. And at the end of which says that, you know, dragons can see excellent by day, even better by night. But in dusk, they have trouble focusing. And that's when, you know, they're huntable, which is kind of amazing. At some point, Van Zant really is just appealing to Quinn, you know. And then he's like, look, we can do this the hard way or the easy way, you know. And kind of telling, giving Quinn the sense that, like, you know, we can blow your doors down and you can let me in and you can trust that I'm a good guy. And then Quinn believes him, and then kind of the moment of believability is a helicopter roars overhead, which gives credence to Van Zant's story. So we realize that he's probably telling the truth.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
I wait with great anticipation when that day comes, but unfortunately it is not with us. I just want to take a brief moment to let you know some ways you can support Sci-Fi on Screen. Patreon at patreon.com is a great way to support any podcast. And that you go to Patreon, you find the podcast you like, you set up a schedule where you would contribute per podcast, and it could be as little as a dollar a show. And the great thing about Patreon is you don't pay a monthly fee regardless of what happens. Only when podcasters produce shows do you actually support them. So you can set it and forget it. You can you know, do it as little as a dollar a show. You can change or quit at any time. So it's a great way to show your appreciation for the show. You could also make one-time support donation at PayPal by using the email scifionscreen@gmail.com, and you can go and make a quick one-time donation as well. And non-monetary ways you can support the show is please share the show on your Facebook page or in some groups that you like. Maybe share it on Reddit. And also, you can go to iTunes in the review, and please tweet it on Twitter. It would all be a great way for you to help get the show out and known to more people. So we meet the helicopter pilot and commander of the dragon takedown team from the air. Her name is Alex Jensen. She's played by Isabella Skorupko, the ex-Bond girl. She's very good in this too, actually. And then we hear some dialogue between her and Quinn. She kind of takes a shine to Quinn, where everyone else is kind of hopped up, you know, like a gung-ho American soldier. Alex Jensen's a little cooler, and she's a little more human. So she gets Quinn to open up a little bit. Him and Creedy talk about how back in the days when everything was just starting, him and a bunch of stragglers made it to this castle and rescued a bunch of children as well. But when he asks her, like, what are you guys doing in England? She's like, any questions of this kind, you have to talk to Van Zant. So it's still a bit of a mystery. But then we're right, here we go. Dragon in the area. There's been dragon sign. The alarm is sounded. Quinn runs all of his duck and hide drills, but Van Zant gathers up his team to go on the offensive. So we witnessed this whole dragon takedown operation, which was very well thought out. How it works is guys on motorcycles drive out to sort of three locations in a rough triangle. They throw these, what they call verticals, into the ground, and they're sort of radar emitting nodules that go upwards. And that sort of the three devices give the helicopter pilot a sort of radar cross-section of a certain area so they can vector in on these dragons, and they fly over them at that point, and a group of what they call archangels, they call themselves, jump out of the helicopter, and they fire these sort of nets at the dragon's wings, which crumple and collapse it, and when it's down on the ground, Van Zant's team comes with the heavy ordnance, and they kill it, which I thought this was really well worked out. Very cool. First, they start with there's a tension scene, right? Two of the verticals go up, the chopper's in the air. They're waiting for this third vertical because Alex Jensen can't see shit without it going up. The dragon gets to the third vertical chopper guy, and he's down. The radio operator in the castle has been monitoring all this, tells Quinn a little bit about this operation and how they do things. And Quinn now looks at the spyglass, and he realizes that that third vertical guy's down. So he jumps on a horse, heads out, gets out there, finds Van Zant's man's down, and he plants the third vertical, which then allows Alex Jensen to see this wonderful 3D little visual. And at that moment, the dragon appears right behind the chopper, and the three of the men jump out of the chopper. So the way they do this is that one of the jumpers, you know, without chutes, goes straight down, and he's the bait. And then the two other archangels hang back, and when the dragon arrows in for the one person, they fire their these weapons that have these chain mesh nets, and they're supposed to get onto either side, each wing of the dragons, and, you know, cripple it. So they do it. They shoot their steel guns at it, which is really cool. And there's a lot of cool aerial photography here because they're jumping out of stuff a lot. And it's shot well, and it's at night, so it's kind of cool. And we see both of the nets kind of encompass the dragon's wings, but it's so foggy and smoky that through the confusion, the dragon throws them off. And they come whizzing by the two Archangel folks. So it didn't work. And then the guy who was bait hits the ground and dies. And the other two parachute down. So the first attack has failed. So now Quinn steps up and he becomes the bait. And he jumps on his horse and rides towards the castle. And Van Zant sort of saying, you know, got him to me and I'll take him out. Now we see Van Zant is sort of sitting in this harpoon jeep. The camera sort of looking through the target reticule. And we see on a distant hill, Quinn kind of just coming over the hill with his horse. And at that moment, Van Zant shoots the harpoon. It goes over Quinn's shoulder and impales the dragon, and the thing hits the ground and dies. It's really cool. I just thought it was a really neat, very well thought out way of how you would fight dragons with modern technology, right? And not super weapons in a way. And now they did a really great sculpture of this downed dragon. Now we're really close to it as it's dead and the mouth is open. We see the teeth and the tongue. It's really very visceral. And of course, Quinn and Creedy and everyone in the castle are just blown out of their socks by this. So that night, there's this celebration at the castle. We hear Jimi Hendrix playing. And Quinn is briefly celebrated by his people. But then Van Zant enters and they cheer the team. But Van Zant gives them this mocking speech like, you people hide in your holes. You're nothing to me. He completely just shames them and berates them, telling them that they're just kind of wastes of life. And everyone just falls silent, and he turns around and leaves. And so we get a sense here in sort of our B-movie mythos that the Brits have retained their humanity. You know, they're still kind of human beings. They still retain the sense of what's important. And yet they've completely ceded the country and the world to the dragons and have kind of given up even thinking about fighting. Whereas the Americans have gone on the offensive, and it has they've come up with all this gee-whiz technology and stuff, and they're able to take dragons down and actually kill them one by one. And yet, it's robbed Van Zant of his humanity. Like, all he is a stalking, killing machine. It's all he can think of. It's all that matters to him. And I just thought that was, for a B-movie, man, and this is why I love spec fic, right? Because it's kind of interesting. I mean, you could think about it now as the U.S. is kind of the policeman of the world, and what are we losing by this continued reliance on might wherever we go, you know? I don't know. So it just made me think of that. But I just like that. And yet, as you're watching the movie, you realize that, like, well, you're going to need both. Because without the humanity of Quinn and his people, what are you saving the planet for? You know, if you've killed all the dragons and all it's done is harden you to the point of madness and aggression and hardness, then the world is, you might as well just let go. And yet, Quinn's people, although they may survive in small places, possibly to wait out the dormancy of these creatures and then come back to life, they really have kind of given up and not fought them at all. So I thought it was very well thought out story-wise that you had two groups of people. You know, normally in these movies, right, it's like one group's the bad guy and they're just bad at everything and they're terrible people and evil and you always want them to die. And one group's the good guys and they're always right and you always want them to win. But in this group, you realize that these two groups need each other. And I just thought that was a little complicated, a little gnarly for kind of these types of movies. You don't normally see that. Dramatically, it takes a little more of a deft hand to write continued dramatic things. And yet there's plenty of drama in it as well. So I don't know. It just I was very impressed by the subtlety of that, if you will. So now we cut to a fairly epic shot at night. Van Zant is standing next to this funeral pyre that was lit for the graves of some of his men that died. Quinn asks him, why are you here? He won't answer him. Now we get some information from Alex Jensen and Van Zant. So what we hear is that the Americans have found out that most of the dragons flying around, if not all of them, are females. We also hear that the fire that the dragons make comes from two chemical sacks. They hold these different chemicals. One sack holds one type of chemical, another sack holds a different one. And when they're ejected together and mixing with the exhalation breath of the beast, they produce what Alex Jensen calls nitro napalm. And I just thought, you know, and the cool thing is that when they do close-ups on the dragons shooting fire, you can see the two jets of sort of gas chemicals coming from either side of the mouth. And then they burst into flame in front of the mouth proper. And I was like, this, they really thought this through. And I always respected that, and I'm always impressed by that kind of unity of story and concept. What they tell him now, they think that there's one male in the entire world that fertilizes the eggs of all the females in the world. So all these females, whenever they're pregnant, fly back to London, and the one single male fertilizes them, and then, you know, the young are born, and off they go, and they're all females that are born. So it's constant females that are born, and one male that fertilizes it, which, very cool, they thought it through. And Van Zandt now has, like, if we can kill dragons, but they reproduce too fast. And if we can kill the male, then the dragons we kill will not come back because their eggs won't be able to be fertilized. And that'll be that. And, you know, the story keeps rolling on. Okay, we got some info. What's next? Got to go to London. Van Zandt wants some of Quinn's men, and Quinn is violently against it. And after Van Zandt walks off, Quinn tells Alex that when he was a child, he saw the male, the one that killed his mother. It was the first one out. Outside of the castle, Van Zandt has this whole speech that he's looking for volunteers to go with his crew to London to replace the men who've died in the last attack. Four men agree, but Van Zandt, you know, that wasn't enough. So at gunpoint, he impresses six more of the men. And at this point, Quinn and Van Zandt fight. It's a pretty good scrap as far as these kind of fights go. It's not like, you know, super choreographed. It's just like two brawny men beating the crap out of each other, which I think fits. But Van Zandt, being a little more crazy and probably more military trained, winds up getting the better of Quinn, and he's having to be pulled off. But it's a very intense scene. McConaughey and Bale are really committed, and I just wonder if each other's presence pushed the other to be even more committed to the role, because they're both pretty charismatic and commanding performers. There's a couple of small other shots, but the main next part of the story, we cut to in the evening, Van Zandt and his crew are rolling through a suburb of London, and we know it's a suburb because we see a sign, you know, London 60 miles, and it's night, and the mail now arrives and pretty much strafes them up a couple of times with fire and kills all of them and destroys their vehicles. And this is one where it looks really great as they linger on the mail as it's blowing fire down, and we do see those two jets of chemical combining, which I really love. And the Van Zandt and maybe a handful of guys survive because I think Van Zandt was underneath one of the vehicles, and the flames just didn't get to him. But he's pretty badly beat up. But the whole convoy is gone, and you know, their chance to go to London and do anything has been wasted. But now, Quinn was really furious at Van Zandt for going, because what he theorized was, you know, if the male finds you, he's just going to keep going and backtrack you to the castle, and that's exactly what happens. So now we have this big male dragon attack of the castle, and lots of long shots of it kind of swooping around and breathing fire. And they're really good. They're long takes, wide and silhouette. It looks really great. And it's not super up close and super detailed, but it's majestic and epic, you know, which I think for dragons kind of needs to be. They keep the dragons mysterious, and we don't really get, you know, we get a look of one of the down dragons at one point, but we don't get a real close up continuous look until the end of the film, which I think is correct. And there's one shot of the male lands and stands up right next to the castle. And I think it looks so much cooler at that point because the castle gives it scale. And it blows a steady stream of fire into the castle, just killing whoever is left upstairs. And the thing is, Quinn is still far off. I think he's off at the fields kind of scouting as the castle burns. And he just kind of slumps, cries, you know. But at some point, he bursts in, and him and Creedy try to rally the survivors. And pretty much, you know, I think there's 60 people left upstairs. A chunk of people did make it to blow. And the male at one point lands on the castle and does the final sort of fire. Creedy is just about to run upstairs to try to save the 60 when the door slams and the fire comes down. And, you know, Creedy kind of saved them, but he and everyone else upstairs are now completely incinerated. It's a pretty brutal scene, you know, because it's mostly kids, and, you know, a really ton of kids died, and Bale really sells it. You know, you really can feel that he spent his whole life trying to protect these people, and half of them just got wiped out, you know? And at the same time, all the detritus from the castle has rained down on them, and the door is jammed shut, so they're trapped in the basement. But not for long. Morning comes, and Van Zandt, and I think Alex comes back, because Alex had flown away in the helicopter when Van Zandt was attacked, and she survived, so she's there. And Van Zandt and her handful of archangels rescue Quinn and the survivors. And Van Zandt capitulates here. And he's like, you know, you were right, Quinn. You were right. Whereas, you know, he's madman and he's crazy. But, like, he comes around, which I love that. You know, I just, I know it's easier to create drama and tension by keeping people unrepentantly bad, right? But I don't know. I kind of love when things are more complex. And I don't know, things kind of line up in this way where Van Zandt regains a little bit of his humanity realizing what had happened. I dig that. So now Quinn kind of takes moral control of the team. He's like, look, we're going to go to London. Because then in his mind, seeing what happened, he realizes that Van Zandt also has a point and that they kind of have to go on the offensive to end this. So I like that too. Like, Van Zandt capitulates and yet Quinn cleaves to him too. And he's like, okay, if we're going to do this, we're going to go in the chopper and we're going to fly below the cliffs. And he knows a way to get into the heart of London without having to fly up high and be vulnerable to the dragons. And they're going to do it at dusk to try to kill this male. So I thought that was great. So they do it. They jump in the chopper. Here's, in a sense, the last act of this film is not so great because there's not a lot of money, I guess. They didn't have a lot of money to spend. So you don't get the real epic London set or London CGI where, like, man, the post-apocalyptic London burnt to the ground. Maybe long shots of them on dead streets. Like, you don't any of that. It's all very close and small shots. And they come in through the underground, like Quinn knows sort of the subway systems and all that. So they kind of come in through underneath. So even though we're at the climactic battle in London, it's very claustrophobic and they're in tunnels and little shacks that are burnt out. And you never get, it doesn't open up into what an A movie would kind of open up into this rousing finale, which it doesn't do. And as much as I decry those things once in a while, there's a reason why they do that. And when they're not there, it takes a very clever movie to deliver the goods in another way. And Rain of Fire doesn't quite have it. They're on the outskirts of London, and there's like hundreds and hundreds of females flying around, and they're basically like, we're dead. But they wait for a bit, and the females, they're theorizing that they're really hungry, and they all leave London to go find food. So the only dragon left is the male. Earlier in the movie, when Van Zandt and Quinn were kind of, you know, dicking up to each other, Van Zandt goes, I lead, you follow. And at this point, Van Zandt turns to Quinn, and he goes, you lead, we'll follow. And I just, again, loved it. Quinn theorizes that the dragon is probably still lives in that underground set of caverns that it first busted out of. So he's basically heading back to where he was a child, where the thing broke out, how he killed his mother. A little bit of lock and load before the final battle. Van Zandt brings out these kind of super crossbow bolts and crossbows. There's no gun. So on the end of the crossbow bolts is what he calls magnesium C4 tips. And so what they have to do is they have to wait until the dragon is just about to burn them. And when it opens its mouth and it inhales, that's when they can shoot the crossbow bolt with the C4 in its mouth and have it blow up in its throat and basically kill it. So that's kind of the plan. The problem is once they get to the construction site, the plan of how to lure the dragon out is very confusing. And it's not, I never know really what's going on, except there's a lot of yelling and the dragon's kind of coming around time and time again. At one point, they split up into a kind of a triangle, right? And I'm not sure why. And Quinn drops his crossbow arrow. Then I guess Alex briefly becomes the bait, drawing out the dragon. And Van Zandt takes aim and he hits it, but he doesn't wait long enough. So it blows up in front of the dragon. So it damages the dragon, doesn't kill it. And then there's a great epic death scene. He's on this high scaffold and the dragon's coming straight at him. And he leaps off the scaffold with an axe in his hand and the camera shoots from below. So it's like leaping over the camera. And it's great, but The dragon completely engulfs Van Zandt and always sees the axe harmlessly fall down, and Van Zandt is now quite dead. But it was a hell of a death scene. Now, you know, we get kind of a chase where the male lands and it's on the ground, seemingly wounded from Van Zandt's crossbow arrow, but it's chasing the two of them. You know, there's the dropped arrow. Quinn sees it, so they make this plan where Alex will be the bait. Quinn will run for the arrow. It's very anticlimactic. There's a final moment where Quinn gets the arrow. He knocks it. The dragon's right in front of him. He waits, shoots, it goes in its throat, blows up, and it's dead. And the dragon close up right there looked a little too CGI for my taste. And there just wasn't enough final drama. It very neatly ended. You know, they very neatly killed the dragon, and it didn't draw me out enough. I think sometimes the tendency is to go too far on these last scenes where you have, you know, six things have to get done and one guy can't do his thing, so someone else has to jump. You know, think of the end of Captain America Winter Soldier, right? There's three ships, like a video game. You have to get to each ship, program in a thing, push a button, then go to the next ship. This one was kind of, they found the dragon, Van Zandt died, they lured it out, and Bale, you know, Quinn killed it. And it's just, I can feel myself as a viewer, like, oh, all right, it's done. You know, and so I didn't really get wrung out, or there was just some, it was very anticlimactic for me, but, you know, there you have it. So the epilogue, they're back at the camp. They build a comm tower now outside on a mountain near the castle, and they receive a signal, and the speaker speaks French, and there's a bit of a joke about it. And then we see Quinn and Alex walk off into the sunset, and we are out. So, Reign of Fire. I mean, overall, it's a really, really solid B movie with great performances, a solid story, a really cool concept that pays off through most of the movie, and really not at the end, but I really like it. You know, like, it's, you know, fantasy with dragons and tanks and helicopters and castles, and I like the two parties not being necessarily all good, each having flaws and each needing the others kind of to push them into what was really necessary. You know, so overall, just a really good movie. I mean, these writers didn't go on to do anything else. Bowman has just went back to TV. I don't think he has done much since then. And I just felt like this was like kind of it was a really, really good proof of concept, really good B movie. And I thought, boy, whoever was involved in this, I would love to see them come together with a little more funds in the bank, what they might do. Because it just, to me, was a crackerjack B movie. It was kind of like, for me, Pitch Black with dragons. You know, the way Pitch Black is a B-movie, and it's a really well-thought-out story, and one thing leads to the next, and the complications are really clever and interesting. This is the same way, you know? I don't think the climax is nearly as interesting in Reign of Fire as Pitch Black, but they just feel the same to me. There's probably a little more money on the screen in Reign of Fire, obviously, but just a really, really solid B-movie from Rob Bowman and team. So, that's about all I have to say about that. I just wanted to remind you guys that all of my archive back catalog is available for 99 cents a show on my website, www.scifionscreen.com. I have an index page which lists it all alphabetically. You can pick as many as you like and download them at 99 cents a show. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.